This is Judaism Unbound, episode 73, Being Both. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And our guest today is author and journalist Susan Katz Miller. Her book, Being Both, looks at the phenomenon of households raising families in multiple religious traditions, folks that are raising their kids or themselves are Jewish and... And her book looks at that phenomenon and argues that, contrary to popular belief, these families have been and can continue to be successful and deeply proud of their Jewish identity while also maintaining a strong connection to another religious tradition. Susan Katz Miller was a longtime leader of the Interfaith Families Project in Washington, D.C., an organization that facilitates community for families looking to live lives imbued with elements of both Judaism and Christianity. We were fascinated to read her book, and we're pleased to welcome Susan Katz Miller to Judaism Unbound. Susan, welcome.
I am thrilled to be here.
Well, we're really thrilled to have you. I'm very excited about having this conversation because it and tangents that come off of your work have been on my mind for a while. So I thought it would really be interesting for our listeners just to get started by giving a little bit of your own story and how you came to be writing and thinking about the topics that you cover in Being Both and in your work.
So my parents were in the first great wave of interfaith marriages. My father was in World War II, and he came out of a kind of a Jewish world and went out into a global world while he was in the service and came back and met my mother in the 1950s. And when they married in 1960, it was still quite unusual for a Jewish man to marry an Episcopalian woman. My parents did what most families were urged to do in the 50s and are still urged to do today, which is that they chose one religion to raise their children in. So my siblings and I were raised in Reform Judaism. We studied Hebrew. We went through the Bar and Bat Mitzvah process. And my mother put aside her religion for the sake of the family. And in Reform Judaism, this was tolerated. It wasn't until I actually graduated from college in 1983 that Reform Judaism, you know, made their ruling about accepting patrilineals. So at that point, people with a Jewish father became kosher in a Reform context. And then in adulthood, I ended up marrying an Episcopalian, and he was willing to raise Jewish children. I was the one who said, you know what? I want my children educated about their full family history. I want them to develop bonds of affection to both religions in the family and to understand both religions as deeply as possible. So we're going to raise them both. And that seemed like a very radical decision, but actually, in the 1980s, a grassroots movement began to build where families were coming to this same decision independently of each other, and communities were forming, mainly in Chicago, New York, and Washington. Those are the three largest, where interfaith families created their own curricula and their own communities to support each other in giving interfaith children interfaith education. So we then became part of that national network, and I became a board chair of our community in Washington, D.C. I then began to work on my book. I spent about 10 years working on the book that became Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. And that 10 years included surveys of parents who were doing both about why they had chosen this pathway, and a survey of young adults who'd been raised with both to get a kind of a first qualitative glimpse at what happens when they get an interfaith education. And does that screw them up? Does that confuse them? You know, what are the benefits? What are the drawbacks? So that's the backbone of the book. And I tell the stories of families across the country. I also tell some stories of beyond Judaism and Christianity, interfaith families who are Muslim, Christian, Hindu, Christian, and that sort of interfaith next generation.
You mentioned in particular some educational contexts where being both kinds of families are actually normalized and centralized. And I'd love to hear, you mentioned New York, Chicago, and DC, and I'd love to hear more about what those look like and, you know, flesh it out for our listeners who might be curious. Like, what does it mean to have like a classroom where both Christianity and Judaism, or it, theoretically two other religions are both sort of being taught alongside or interwoven with each other?
Each of these programs grew up independently, but they all came to the same concept, which is that in every classroom, you have a Jewish teacher and a Christian teacher, so that the kids always have a way of seeing through two lenses, even though they can't represent all points of view. So it might be somebody who grew up as a conservative Jew and somebody who grew up as a Catholic as their teachers. Or it might be somebody who grew up as a, you know, secular Jew and someone who grew up as a Presbyterian. That's very different. But at least they have both lenses. And those parents, because, well, in Washington, D.C., in our program, we have parents as teachers. They are simultaneously modeling this bridge building between the two teachers. So the kids see those teachers working together, and they see the ways in which they have differences, the ways in which they have commonalities. Both are important. That's why the cover of my book is a Venn diagram. It has a central space, but it also has the spaces that are not overlapping, and those spaces are equally important. The groups around the country differ in other ways. For instance, our group in Washington, D.C., which has over 120 families in it now, we have both a rabbi and a minister on staff as leadership. And that was important to our group, that the kids have somebody who is, trained in theology and able to bring to us everything that a rabbi and a minister brings. They officiate at life cycle ceremonies, etc. Not all the groups have decided to go that way. Some of the groups have affiliations with local synagogues and local churches, that they have actual formal relationships on both sides. And the New York groups use seminary students as their teachers instead of parents, which is interesting. Obviously, seminary students bring a lot of deep theological understanding to the classroom. I would point out that there's another myth that only people with very low levels of religious education would enter an interfaith marriage or would choose interfaith education for their kids, and that is absolutely not true. We have many members who've made this choice for their families who have divinity degrees, who thought about going into the rabbinate but couldn't because they were intermarried. We even have some families who are raising kids with a label of Judaism only, but they want their kids to have that interfaith education. You know, right now, especially under Trump, with everything going on in the world, a lot of people are feeling that interfaith education is more important than ever for everybody, for all adults, for all children. But especially if you're a child who has this family background, who has this tree, then I think it's the most important for those kids, just to understand themselves and to understand their extended family.
As I'm listening to you, I'm trying to sort of think through, well, what is a simile to this? You know, sort of in my mind, actually, you know, you brought the connection to politics. You know, I'm thinking, what would it be like if a Democrat married a Republican and wanted to raise the kids as both? Like, what does that look like? And I think, and the question is that a flawed analogy? And what's really at the core of this? Because I think that the people that kind of have an objection to this in some way imagine that Judaism and Christianity or Christianity and Islam or whatever, that they have some core dimensions that are fundamentally irreconcilable with one another as a practice or as a theology, and that it wouldn't really be possible to be both because they are in tension with one another. And so so of course, we could learn about both, and that would be wonderful, and we could certainly marry somebody from the other tradition and sort of keep those parts of our life in a kind of private realm. But ultimately, how do we build a family that is both if they are in tension or in conflict with one another? And I guess the question is whether the families who are doing this sort of get to a point where they they interpret both in such a way that there's not a sense of an irreconcilable conflict between them, or that ultimately the result of a sort of a positive result from building an interfaith family is that some kind of hybrid is developed that is actually really great, that takes the best of both, that's syncretistic in a good way for those people, even if there might be folks that are committed to the singular expression of it that would see that as not a good thing.
I absolutely own the fact that there is a cognitive dissonance, but we talk about the idea of embracing the cognitive dissonance. And we talk about cognitive dissonance as an engine for creativity, as something that forces you to think more deeply, as something that can actually inspire you, as something that encourages you to think outside of the boxes and to look at any and all dogma with a skeptical eye. So, I think there's a legitimate concern that, you know, children raised with both will be, you know, so intellectual in their approach that they will miss the kind of juiciness of the spirituality. But on the other hand, we have a lot of younger people talking about how they are claiming spirituality without the dogma, you know. So we make a lot of effort for our children to have what I consider spiritual experiences. We sing together. We take them into nature and, you know, encourage them to think about to what extent those experiences are imbued with God, if that's the way they see the world. So I believe that spirituality actually is a function of the human neurological system, and it's something that's stimulated by a certain kind of architecture, a certain kind of musical engagement or artistic engagement, and that it does not require a consistent theology or dogma to access that. But the place where I'm trying to get the people doing both to influence or engage with the religious institutions is the idea that religious institutions, for their own good, I think would do well to not shut the door to these families. These are families that are trying to cultivate, you know, affectionate bonds with Judaism, since I'm on a Jewish podcast here, but also with Christianity. And are you really going to say no to a family that is seeking out Jewish education? I really am working on forming alliances with people who are ready to challenge the idea that a synagogue should exclude a child who wants to get Jewish education, who wants to deepen their affection for Judaism, just because they are also learning about their other parents' religion or even having formative experiences in the other parents' religion. And we're not insignificant. We are not a crazy minority. I mean, in here, we have to look at Pew 2013 found 25% of Jewish parents in interfaith marriages choosing both in some way. And there are cities in which more interfaith families are doing both than are doing Jewish only. Now, they may or may not have formal organizations like the ones in New York, Chicago, and Washington. So some of the families doing both in the middle of the country, if they don't have a community in which to do it, it looks very different, and it's going to be harder. So part of my work now is trying to help those people find each other. I have a Facebook group, which is a network for families doing both to find each other in different places. And we're starting to spin off informal groups in new locations that are formed by people doing both who didn't even necessarily know about my book, didn't know there was anybody else around them doing this, but it's helping them to find each other.
I wanted to dig in a little more. You've mentioned a couple times in this conversation about how being both in a way like even beyond. So already we know, and we've talked about in the past, that interfaith marriage is already, forgetting any of the specifics of how children are raised, is already like a hot button issue. And then being both is sort of seen within that as extra radical because it's the set of interfaith people who are not focused just on raising children Jewish, and that sort of, and I want to sort of take on the specifics of that, because I think there could be a tendency, I do this, and easily a listener could do this, where they say, oh, I get, like, we shouldn't be closing the door on anyone. But then when we keep it abstract and we don't look at the specific ways it's happening, we have a danger of assuming, like, the problem is elsewhere and not our own families of institutions. So I want to, like, name a few things about how people who are both have moments where they could feel pain or feel marginalized in the Jewish community. One that comes to mind is that the denomination that I am most familiar with because of my own upbringing is Reform. And whenever anybody converts into Reform Judaism, the thing they have to say is that they will practice Judaism to the exclusion of all other religions. That's like sort of when you say a few sentences at your ceremony, that's like the official thing that you must say. And as a result, if you are somebody who identified as both, that would be a major challenge. Or if you were somebody who didn't identify as both but wanted to convert into Judaism alongside something else, that could pose a problem. You mentioned the patrilineal issue. We continue to have situations. We have entire movements that don't recognize Jews who only have a father as a parent. We also have, and you mentioned this in your book, there's a fascinating anecdote about birthright, actually, where a requirement of going on a birthright trip is that you are practicing only Judaism and not something else. And what's interesting about this is people say, like, I think people are under the assumption that that's like to prevent Messianic Jews to go on birthright. I've talked with people who have said that directly, and they've even said to me, like, well, if somebody was Jewish and Buddhist, I don't think it would be a problem. But what you name in your book is that there's actually a situation where somebody, I think his name was Diego, says in the birthright interview, hey, I've grown up with both Judaism and Christianity. I feel a strong connection to both. There are elements of both that shape who I am. I'm not Messianic. And he's told he's not eligible. We have just a litany of these things. We've got the fact that, I mean, you mentioned earlier that if you're a rabbi in an interfaith relationship, forgetting how your children are being raised, that's sort of a line that is still unable to be crossed in all movements except Reconstructionism and Renewal. I don't say this to, like, bash all of these institutions. That's not why I'm doing it. But I think it's important to take what's abstract about this in terms of shutting the door on people and say, here's how it's actually happening in the vast majority of our contexts. And I guess I was just curious, from your own experience or from the people you've spoken with, if there are particular elements of Jewish life, language or programming or whatever, that is proving to be not just sort of one person's problem, it's a barrier to a large set of people feeling fully comfortable in Jewish spaces. I'd love to hear more about what those big ticket problems are.
A lot of the families I work with, you know, the issue they're dealing with is being told they can't enroll their children in a Jewish religious education program. It's a policy. And there are synagogues that go by a sort of don't ask, don't tell, where they know the kids are involved with both, but they just don't want to know about it because they want their bodies in the program, or because they, you know, really empathize and feel that the children should be in the program, and they just aren't going to ask so that they don't have to think about the policy. In my opinion, that policy needs to change. I come at my Jewish life from a Reform perspective as well, because that's the way my family is Reform going back generations. I do, of course, believe that children should be allowed to claim Judaism no matter which parent was Jewish. And the whole idea of matrilineality makes no sense to me in a context where we have families composed of two moms or two dads or one mom or one dad. You know, how do you go about figuring out if that's a matrilineal family? It doesn't even make sense to me anymore, honestly. You know, we have parents who are gender fluid, who are intersex, like, no, just move away from the gender stuff, people. I've been Reform Jew all my life, so it's very hard for me to kind of go back to worrying about that. But I will say that the fact that the different Jewish streams disagree on this point creates another very alienating situation where, you know, my feeling is, If we all can't even agree on this, then I'm not really interested in even being part of that conversation. I'm just going to go over here and do my Jewish thing. And if you don't want to consider me Jewish, fine. That's your problem. Whatever. It's hard not to get a little bit, you know, spicy about it.
Yeah, but that's why, like, I think that what you describe, right, these organizations, it's very exciting to me, right? Because it's people who are saying, there are probably many people who do wish that they would be more embraced by the existing institutions. But I think it's exciting to see that these folks care so much that they're creating their own institutions. And the question becomes, you know, A, can they pull the community over towards them over time? And B, to the extent that there are people out there who essentially hear an idea like that and they say, yeah, that sounds really good. And then, oh, but, you know, they come up with all these concerns. And I do want to surface, you know, some of the concerns and talk about them, because I think that there are probably answers to them. But I think people tend not to think deeply about them. And so they aren't sure what the answers are, you know. And so, for example, just on the education thing, I have spoken to some educators about it, very, very forward thinking Jewish educators about their concerns. And at least I've heard the concern from some really forward thinking Jewish educators that they don't have any objection to having a child there that's being raised as both. They personally aren't at all concerned about it and would very much like it, but they don't have the pedagogy. They don't know what to do if that child would talk a lot about how he or she believes in Jesus and all of these kind of things, and that the other children would be confused, or maybe the parents of the other children would be upset that their child came home from Jewish religious school, you know, talking about Jesus, and they just want to sort of not get into that can of worms. I mean, I think that that's the concern that I've heard. And by the way, I want to connect it to, I think, what you, or I don't remember who said it earlier, but I do think that this is not necessarily unique to Christianity, but I think it's highly, the issue of Christianity is major, because I really don't think, and I don't hear these same concerns expressed about Buddhism or Hinduism or
even Islam.
Even Islam, I don't know. I haven't heard it come up too much, but you know, there are fewer for
it's
other
about
reasons. Yeah. So that'll be interesting, right? That'll be very interesting. But I'm just sort of curious, at least as a starting point, like, what do you have to suggest to those educators that actually have real pedagogical concerns and aren't sure how to handle the situation?
I think this is parallel to fears and conversations that were going on, say, 15, 20 years ago about a child in the classroom who might have a Christmas tree at home. And, you know, Jewish institutions were still telling these families, if you want to join our synagogue, you can't have a Christmas tree because your kid will come to school and freak out the other kids by talking about their Christmas tree. And somehow we've been able to move to a place where, you know, half the kids in the class might have Christmas trees and it's okay. And you know, the teachers, the educators have figured out how to negotiate this in the classroom, and they will figure it out on this level as well. You know, when you say that a child might say they believe in Jesus, part of what we talk about in our communities is, what does that even mean? You know, there tends to be an idea in Judaism that Christianity is a binary, you know, believe in Jesus or don't believe in Jesus kind of thing. And when you talk to the plurality of Christians in America today, you're going to find a very wide, you know, variety of beliefs about Jesus. You know, do you feel that Jesus was an important rabbi and teacher? Do you believe that Jesus is, you know, the only son of God or a son of God? What does that mean? What is a son? What is God? You know, you start breaking it down and it becomes very much less clear. So an individual kid coming to that classroom, you know, their Christian parent might have any number of beliefs about Jesus. You don't even know what they are just because they have a label of Presbyterian or a label of Catholic. And that child will be learning about those beliefs. They'll be thinking about, what does my Christian parent think? What do I think? They're going to be working all of this out. And Jewish educational institutions have begun to realize that we do a disservice to our Jewish students if we ignore Christianity, if we don't teach them about Christianity. And often, unfortunately, it's kind of saved for post-confirmation, post-bar mitzvah. You know, now that they're very clear in their Jewish identity, we can let them find out about who was Jesus. You know, when did Christianity actually branch off from Judaism? It wasn't in Jesus's life, it was later. And, you know, what is that whole history? And there's a fear that children can't handle this until they're older. Families that are doing both look at it very differently. We look at it as akin to being bilingual. And to become bilingual, the earlier you learn both languages, you know, the easier it's going to be. So we're allowing the children to have this exposure. And as they get older, you know, they become clearer about what they feel, about what their parents feel, and they become more educated about the variety of beliefs available to them in Christianity and Judaism. Just to mention Buddhism briefly, at one point I wrote something about how Buddhism is like the fun uncle. It doesn't threaten it, doesn't threaten anybody. You know, it's easily layered on Judaism. It's cool to be a Jew-boo or a Boo-Jew. And somehow it doesn't have any of that fraught nature that you have with Judaism and Christianity. And that's because Judaism and Christianity are siblings. They, you know, they their histories are intertwined. And there's a lot of pain and a lot of really, you know, tragic moments in that history that we need to acknowledge. We're not papering over that. Whereas Buddhism comes in fresh and, you know, just gets to have fun and, you know, not have be part of that fraught history. But it is a little bit frustrating for those of us who are advocating for allowing interfaith education for children to encounter people who are fine with doing Buddhism and Judaism, but not allowing any Christianity in the mix. Islam is a really interesting case because in Islam, Jesus is seen as a prophet, not as a god. And so in some ways, that's an easier fit, believe it or not, for Jews than Christianity is. And we're beginning to see more Jewish-Muslim interfaith marriage going forward. I'm working with some of those families. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree. So I want to agree and also add a possibility into the mix for why Judaism, Christianity, in terms of these various Judaism hyphens, is particularly complicated and baggage ridden for people. Because I definitely agree that the fact of the sibling nature and the history of it is real. But I actually, like, the more and more I think about it, because I've been wrestling with this a lot lately, the reason why I'm so confident that as Islam becomes, as Jewish-Muslim relationships become more normalized and just the quantity of them continues to increase in a country where I believe Muslims are now about the same population in America as Jews, and demographic wise will probably be a little more before too much time goes. But what's interesting to me is sort of the nature of our country where Christianity is not just another religion, it's the predominant religion. And when people are marrying a Christian historically, and even today for many people, the perception in people's mind is not merely that you're like connecting with, that you're making a bridge to some other religion in the way you are with Buddhism or Taoism, or I would claim Islam, but actually that you are sort of, nobody would say this, but you're like selling out. And the classic word is assimilation. You've just gone to the mainstream. And for a Jew, and we've talked about this with some of our guests in a variety of different contexts, it seems our minority-ness or our otherness is actually like really crucial to a lot of different kinds of Jews across the spectrum. And so my claim, and I mean, we'll know over the next few decades, is my claim is that Jewish-Muslim relationships will never have, at least not in our lifetimes, the level of baggage that Jewish-Christian relationships do, because it just doesn't represent the same kind of entry into the rest of society in people's minds as the rest. Because it's very clear in today's world that Muslims are even more marginalized than us. It's like we get that and we feel like, okay, so there's two minorities coming together here and still on the margins.
Right. So it doesn't have that same minority-majority power dynamic. But you can't say that a Jewish-Muslim relationship isn't going to have as much baggage. I mean, the Middle East. Hello. That's so difficult for those families.
It's a different baggage.
And this is, you know, what I write about is the idea that every combination is going to have specific challenges and specific synergies. So if you're a Muslim Jewish family and you're both from the Middle East, either recently or way back, you have things that you share. You share a certain connection to that region of the world. But at the same time, it's a nightmare because you have to live with Israel-Palestine full time. Even if you're from, you know, India and Chicago, that whole history imposes itself on your relationship. And so that's your major challenge. You could maybe share a way of looking at Jesus if one is Muslim and one is Jewish. You might both feel that, you know, Jesus was an important teacher and prophet. So you don't have that issue that a Christian Jewish family is going to have. But there's different challenges with each type of duo. I gave a talk and I was hosted by a Jewish institution and one of the leaders was there and she said to me, you know, I'm Reform, my husband's Orthodox. You can't believe how hard it is. It's harder than what you're doing. And on some level, she's right. Every relationship is an interfaith relationship. You could both be Reformed Jews and you could have very different ways of practicing, very different family histories, very different beliefs. And you have to work those out as a couple and as a family. I want to speak to a moment to your point of the sort of fetish of being the outsider, the sort of thrill you get of being a minority of how that encourages empathy with other quote unquote minorities. And that is a very kind of Jewish way of looking at things. And it's positive for a lot of us. For those of us doing both in a Jewish and Christian or Jewish and other religious context, we're claiming that. We're like the outsiders of the outsiders. We're like doubly other. So we win. And and we get that thrill out of it. You know, I enjoy that role. I admit it. And I claim that Jewish patrimony, heritage, historical thread of being on the outside and being an observer and being somebody who looks at things and then turns them upside down and looks at them in a different way. On a weird level, it feels super Jewish to me. I mean, there's so many people who would say you're not even Jewish, you're a patrilineal, or you're not even Jewish because you chose this crazy pathway with your kids. But I just claim it for myself.
I think this very question of being both helps sort of scratch at a question that we've been sort of scratching at for a while, which is, you know, deeply what is Judaism? You know, what is religion? That if Judaism is fundamentally defined theologically as, you know, right, one God or fewer, you know, then you potentially have a problem with another religion that defines itself theologically as potentially, depending on how you define it, you know, more than one. The question, though, is that I think that there's a lot of Jews that are not well integrated into the organized Jewish world that are atheists, and there's a lot that are not atheists, you know, but they fundamentally aren't all that concerned about all the mechanics of how, you know, Judaism has traditionally worked and would be sort of probably profoundly open to some kind of new definition of what it is that this is in the world, right? Meaning that they don't necessarily have such a stake in calling it Judaism on the other side of it, right? Or maybe they would like to call it Judaism on the other side of it, but just as a lot of people feel totally comfortable with a Judaism that's highly infused with Buddhism, they might very well feel very comfortable with a Judaism that was syncretic in many other ways.
For me, syncretic is not a bad word. I mean, historically, it has been used as a negative, but for me, it's not. I do want to say that I find tremendous beauty and value in the highly evolved architecture of Judaism, in the songs, in the texts, in the history. And I am absolutely not trying to, you know, assault that fortress. It does feel like a fortress sometimes. It's hard to get in, but I acknowledge the value of it. And I think for the Jewish partners in a lot of our families, there is that yearning to be in a community that has that official stamp of approval. It's hard to get away from that. But we're also acknowledging that there's a yearning on behalf of the Christian partner or the Buddhist partner or the Muslim partner. And we can't just roll over that in the name of Jewish continuity. And that kind of yearning and that kind of sadness of being forced to put aside your religion for the sake of unity in the family can backfire. Ultimately, it doesn't always. It sometimes it works out fine. Sometimes that partner will convert and you will end up in a monofaith family. But we have to acknowledge the yearning on both sides.
We've had B'nai Lapi on a few times, who is LGBT. She's founded an LGBT yeshiva, and we've talked about this question of inclusivity towards LGBT folks, or that they should create their own institutions, and that in many ways that's a powerful model. But the other piece has been the sort of the way in which, for me, as somebody who's not gay, I found that this LGBT yeshiva is incredibly for me, because I feel excluded from the Jewish community for other reasons, right? And so a community that's fundamentally built by people who feel excluded, they weren't trying to do this for me, they were trying to do this for them, but it opens up that possibility. And I feel like I've read that in what you were writing, that LGBT clergy perhaps are more understanding and have more openness to ideas about what can be done here. And I'm interested in if you want to talk about that. And I'm also interested in the extent to which the disruption that you represent is important for interfaith families, but it also potentially might be important for people who are Jewish and who both partners are Jewish, but they couldn't imagine doing some of the things that they actually would very much respond to. But if they sort of understand it as, well, I'm, inspired by what you're doing, that there's really some power there.
A lot of the clergy who are supportive of doing both are from the LGBTQ community. And I think part of that is because they just see things from an outside the box perspective, and they're very comfortable with the idea that some of what's been written in our texts historically has to be changed. So already you're sort of freed from a level of literal religious fundamentalism or a literalism that will allow you to think about interfaith families the way I think about them. There are parallels between interfaith families and LGBTQ families. There are parallels between interfaith families and interracial families. But there are also limits to those metaphors. I try not to go around culturally appropriating the language of other movements, but they are very much allied movements in a lot of ways, in part because a lot of our families are all three. We have gay parents who are interracial and interfaith, and they can talk better than I can about the ways in which these movements are allied and are synergistic, and you can learn from each other and are intersectional, by nature. And I'm really looking forward to some of our first kids who were raised with both going into religious leadership in Judaism and in other religions and bringing with them their perspective on the world. I think that could be a tremendous benefit to any religious institution, and certainly to Judaism. And I think, sadly, probably the first wave is going to be quiet about their backgrounds. They're probably going to be like, okay, I chose Judaism, don't ask questions. Or, maybe they convert, and so that they have those Jewish bona fides so that people will not question whether they have standing to speak as a Jewish leader. But eventually, demographically, we're just going to become more important and have an effect on those institutions. So, I'm looking forward to seeing that transition. It's already happening with, the first rabbinical school accepting students in interfaith relationships. And, that's going to continue to shift.
One of the pieces that I found most refreshing and wonderful about your book and your framing is that it was just so much less defensive than I'm used to seeing in this conversation. The vast majority of articles I read and people I hear speak about interfaith marriage in the Jewish world are the ones that I really like. They're coming from a place of, no, we're actually not destroying the Jewish future. And so all of the articles are like, look at these ways that we're not destroying everything. And like interfaith Jews aren't terrible. And these families aren't totally confused. And the kids are like, and we need to have those conversations. It's important because people have these internalized perceptions of what it means to have an interfaith marriage or to be an interfaith family or whatever. But what I love about your book is that you said, actually, I'm not going to spend all my time defending. Here's how interfaith relationships are really great. And the people that are forged in these being both contexts bring unique skills as a result of their life experiences that are really important for the world. And so I'd love to just hear from you as we close out, like what it is about this project of, you know, being both that's actually just a really incredible good service to the world.
So the original title of my book that I proposed was The Joy of Being Both. And I think the publisher wanted something punchier. You know, being both is short and punchy, and I've come to love that title. Or maybe Joy of Being Both, there was too much...
Joy of cooking.
Or joy of sex, yeah. So, but anyway, I was a little bit sad about losing joy from the title because that is part of my experience that I wanted to document, and the experiences of a lot of these other families was that it is a joyful thing being in an interfaith family, and that those stories were not being told because so much of the literature came from a place of, you know, fraught, you know, panic about continuity, and they weren't looking at the experience of the actual families, which can be very joyful and creative. And my parents had one of the most joyful marriages I ever encountered. My mother died in September, but they were, you know, in a beautiful marriage. And so I grew up with this experience of an interfaith marriage being a beautiful thing. Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family is my subtitle. And I very much purposefully wanted embrace in there as another positive. And there are things lost with any pathway you choose. There are always going to be losses. Anytime you go through a door, you're choosing not to go through other doors. That is the way life is. But I wanted to claim and document the idea that interfaith bridge building is important and that doing it on this micro scale in the family actually leads, it has a ripple out effect that those children then go out and form interfaith bridges with their classmates, and they can help explain their family. They can, you know, model to others the idea that love can conquer. I do see it as a political statement, and I see the rights of interfaith families to be who they are as a kind of a social justice issue. So for me, this is political. Especially under Trump, it feels all the more important to model that kind of peacemaking, that kind of joy, that kind of creativity that can come from sharing our traditions with each other, teaching each other our songs and our foods and our cultures and our languages. I know I'm sounding kumbaya right now, but I'm here doing this because there are so many other people who are looking at it through such a negative lens still. And I think they need to listen to not my story, but the stories of all of the other interfaith families around them now, and make space for those families to tell their stories in an honest way and not feel that they have to conform to a monofaith model or present themselves as monofaith when we know all families are on some level interfaith.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. It's been a fascinating one, and I really look forward to just continuing to internalize all of what you've brought and have it affect our future conversations. So thank you again, Susan Katzmiller.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode with Susan Katz-Miller, and we wanted to close it out in the same way we always do, by encouraging you out there to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways that you can do that. First, you can always head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, we encourage you to be in touch with us via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with a monetary donation at judaismunbound.com/donate, and that can be either a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.